content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello and welcome to Heard Any Good Books Lately? A program from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm George Douglas. This program is brought to you by the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. It's an organization of citizens, volunteers, and patrons, all interested in supporting the library and the services it provides. The Friends Group was founded in 1989 and now has more than 300 members across North Carolina. If you'd like to join the Friends Group yourself, we'll have information on how you can do that later in this program. But this program is all about books, with special emphasis on those available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. Now, the library has more than 86,000 titles in its collection. Books and magazines are available in large print, braille, and talking books as well. Now, the library has more than 11,000 patrons across the state of North Carolina, and if you're not a patron but are interested in becoming one, I'll have more information at the end of this program as well. Now, this month we will take a look at some of the most popular books checked out during the month of October 2015 at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Our first book we're going to talk about today is Small Wars. It's a Jack Reacher story by the very popular author Lee Child. Now, in this ebook exclusive story, number one New York Times bestselling author Lee Child goes back to 1989 when Jack Reacher is an MP assigned to solve the cold-blooded murder of a young officer whose killer may be closer to Reacher than he suspects. The telex is brief and to the point. One active duty personnel found shot to death 10 miles north of Fort Smith. Circumstances unknown. Found in a silver Porsche along an isolated forest road in Georgia, the victim was shot twice in the chest and once in the head. A professional hit, clean. The crime scene suggests an ambush. Military police officer Jack Reacher is given the case. He calls his older brother, Colonel Joe Reacher, at the Pentagon for intel and taps Sergeant Francis Neagley to help him answer the big question. Who would kill a brilliant officer on the fast track to greatness? For Jack Reacher, the answer hits home. That was actually the most popular book during the month of October at the Library for the Blind. Small Wars, A Jack Reacher Story by Lee Child. Now let's talk about The Murder House by James Patterson and David Ellis. It has an oceanfront view, a private beach, and a deadly secret that won't stay buried. Number 7, Ocean Drive, is a gorgeous multi-million dollar beachfront estate in the Hamptons, where money and privilege know no bounds. But its beautiful Gothic exterior hides a horrific past. It was the scene of a series of depraved killings that have never been solved. Neglected, empty, and rumored to be cursed, it's known as the Murder House, and locals keep their distance. Detective Jenna Murphy used to consider herself a local, but she hasn't been back since she was a girl. Trying to escape her troubled past and rehabilitate a career on the rocks, the former New York City cop hardly expects her lush and wealthy surroundings to be a hotbed of grisly depravity. But when a Hollywood power broker and his mistress are found dead in the abandoned murder house, the gruesome crime scene rivals anything Jenna experienced in Manhattan. And what at first seems like an open-and-shut case turns out to have as many shocking secrets as the murder house itself, as Jenna quickly realizes that the mansion's history is much darker than even the town's most salacious gossips could have imagined. As more bodies surface and the secret that Jenna has tried desperately to escape closes in on her, she must risk her own life to expose the truth before the murder house claims another victim. full of the twists and turns that have made James Patterson the number one bestseller in the world. The Murder House is a chilling, page-turning story of murder, money, and revenge. Again, The Murder House, and that was co-written by very popular author James Patterson, along with David Ellis. Now, one of the most popular books during the month of October is one that has gotten a lot of publicity, and you probably may have guessed it. It is called Go Set a Watchman. It's the novel by Harper Lee, the author who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird more than 70 years ago. And there's a warning with this review, actually. It says this review comes with a disclaimer, and not the one you would expect. There has been so much media attention and controversy surrounding the publication of Go Set a Watchman, and whether or not Harper Lee truly wanted it published or if she had been manipulated into doing so by her representatives. The state of Alabama was even called in to investigate charges of elder abuse. The state determined that Lee was of sound mind when she was able to answer questions about the book to investigator satisfaction. No one was more cynical about the circumstances than me, the reviewer of this. A lifelong fan, I had accompanied my friend, writer Shannon McKenna Schmidt, to the author's hometown of Monroeville, Alabama, in 2007 to research a book that she was co-authoring on literary travel. Novel Destinations was the name of that book by Joni Rendon. And almost immediately we were put through our paces by Lee's sister, Miss Alice Lee, an attorney and her representative. Now, Shannon had to explain why we were in town, what kind of book she was researching, and how it related to Lee. Her privacy and literary legacy were that guarded. So when it was announced that this notoriously low-profile author, Harper Lee, who had repeatedly said she would not publish a second book, was going to do just that, I was instantly wary and disbelieving. The historic publication of Watchmen has made headlines worldwide, and the anticipated backlash has only just begun. It's hard to follow a first novel like To Kill a Mockingbird, a classic that has been on school curricula for decades and has been adapted into a timeless film with the legendary Gregory Peck, becoming the visual archetype of a man who stands up for justice, no matter what the cost. Did Lee intend for this to be published in her lifetime, or is she being controlled by a puppet master attorney calling all the shots? Well, to get swept up in the scandal of it all would be a reader's first mistake. The second would be to approach this novel as anything other than what it is, a first version of what later would become the classic story of right and wrong in the American South. This isn't To Kill a Mockingbird 2. This is what Harper Lee wrote in the mid to late 1950s. She handed it in to her editor, and it was mutually decided to put this version aside in order to focus more on the character of Scout as a young child through the prism of a young child's idealized version of her father. Now, to fall prey to those mistakes would rob the reader of what could potentially be a fascinating and enlightening look into the writing process of an author trying to wrangle many topical issues of her day, amazingly many of which resonate so strongly today. So having said that, I would recommend, says the reviewer, that most of whom I'm sure are fans of Lee's, that if you want to enjoy Watchmen, remember to approach it realistically as an early version that was reworked and reconfigured many times, one that contains glimpses and glimmers of the classic story that it would eventually become after much careful sculpting by the author and her gifted editor, Tay Hohoff. If one approaches it almost like a scholar, not expecting a prequel to Mockingbird, but rather appreciating the peek inside the process, then the reading experience will be a much more rewarding one. Unlike the scrawny tomboy of Mockingbird, Watchmen is narrated by 26-year-old Jean Louise Finch, still Scout to most of her family and friends in Macomb, Alabama, who is returning to the South of the mid-1950s from New York City, where she currently lives, to visit her aging father, Atticus. As with most 20-somethings visiting their small hometowns, one observes things with a slightly jaundiced eye. Due to his arthritis, getting around is tougher for Atticus these days. Instead of meeting Jean Louise at the station, he sends Hank, his employee at the law firm, makeshift honorary son, and Jean Louise's sometimes boyfriend. This trip seems to serve a dual purpose for her. Of course, she wants to see her father, but it's almost as if the adult scout is testing the waters, almost in a Jane Austen-like fashion, to see if she could, or should, return here for good, to accept a life where she would marry Hank, have children, take care of her father, and join the ranks of the good Christian citizens of Macomb. But we see that Jean Louise still maintains all the spark and stubbornness of young scout as she immediately bristles and rails against this picture. Responding to Hank's frequent proposals of marriage, she admits her fear of the outcome. "It's just that I'm so afraid of making a mess of being married to the wrong man. The wrong kind for me, I mean. I'm no different from any other woman, and the wrong man would turn me into a screaming shrew in record time." One thing that seems to remain unwavering to the adult scout is her idealized version of her father. Atticus Finch's secret of living was so simple, it was deeply complex. Where most men had codes and tried to live up to them, Atticus lived his to the letter with no fuss, no fanfare, and no soul-searching. His private character was his public character. His code was simple, New Testament ethic. Its rewards were the respect and devotion of all who knew him. Even his enemies loved him, because Atticus never acknowledged they were his enemies. He was never a rich man, but he was the richest man his children ever knew, which may explain her fear of committing to one man. So few of them were like Atticus. But then she catches Atticus and Hank in attendance at a citizens' council meeting from her perch in the balcony of the courthouse, in a scene that slightly mirrors the classic court scene from Mockingbird, and overhears the crowd listening to the racist bluster of the speaker, who denounces a government that is attempting to mongrelize his South by integrating whites with the black population. Aghast that her father is silently listening to this bigotry, she reflects back on a case she handled when she was young, where he defended a young black boy who had been accused of raping a white girl. He won an acquittal for the boy, a very different outcome than the Tom Robinson case that was at the heart of Mockingbird. So how could he stand there and listen to this drivel? The weight of what she has just witnessed makes her sick to her stomach. The one human being she had ever fully and wholeheartedly trusted had failed her. The only man she had ever known to whom she could point and say with expert knowledge, "He is a gentleman. In his heart, he is a gentleman," had betrayed her publicly, grossly, and shamelessly. Well, the reader, too, has a visceral reaction to seeing his or her hero succumb to the racism of his peers, but when Jean Louise confronts Atticus about his attendance and subsequent silence in the face of what she perceives as hate speech, he responds much like any man of his age and era. Of course, this misconstrued nugget of information is what every review or article is latching on to: Atticus is racist. It's the ageless trope of entering adulthood by finally seeing your parents for who they are, people with faults. Her Uncle Jack lectures her that this realization was bound to happen. "Now you, miss, born with your own conscience and somewhere along the line fastened it like a barnacle onto your father's, as you grew up, you confused your father with God. You never saw him as a man with a man's heart and a man's failings. I'll grant you that it may have been hard to see. He makes so few mistakes, but he makes them like all of us." One also thinks that perhaps in this early draft of the story, Atticus is a more realistic version of the author's father, A.C. Lee, and the Atticus in Mockingbird is the romanticized one. Many of the arguments between the adult Scout and Atticus uncannily mirror issues being discussed today, especially the discussion of states' rights versus federalism. And the scene of Aunt Alexandra's coffee gathering exhibits a comic observation worthy of Bridget Jones. So if the reader approaches Watchmen with the proviso that this is a first version of a classic story, the early outline of what was to be, it can be enjoyed on this level, as an example of how the writing process can be long and laborious and mutable. No one judges the film The Godfather on the basis of Francis Ford Coppola's storyboarded notes. The same thought process applies here. This is Mockingbird in its earliest stages, not the classic we've come to know and revere. I can see book groups now going into overtime discussing the issues and differences between this and the 1960 version. No matter what the reasons behind its publication, Watchmen can and should be appreciated for exactly what it is. And that was reviewed and written by Bronwyn Miller back in July of 2015. Go Set a Watchman, the very controversial, and I must say, having read the book myself, the very wonderful book by Harper Lee. And you're listening to Heard Any Good Books Lately, a feature of the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Our next book is Robert B. Parker's The Devil Wins, written by Reed Farrell Coleman. The Devil Wins is Reed Farrell Coleman's second novel since he has taken over the Robert B. Parker series of Jesse Stone novels. Now, anyone that was a Parker fan, and myself included, I was a big fan of his, and those new to the world of Paradise Police Chief Jesse Stone should enjoy these stories. Coleman expands on the supporting cast of characters he inherited from Parker. He's able to create his own very well-developed characters that add to the plotline and allows the readers to learn more about the small town of Paradise, Massachusetts. Now, in this novel, the Paradise's residents allow readers to see how the town developed over the years. The reason for this is that the story is both a cold case and a new case having to do with the town's occupants. After a storm, three corpses are found, a man wrapped in a tarp, along with the skeletal remains of two teenage girls. After being examined, the girls are identified as Mary Kate O'Hara and Virginia Connolly, two 16-year-olds who vanished about 25 years earlier during a 4th of July celebration. Now, the crime predates Jesse's arrival into Paradise and also involves one of his police officers, Molly Crane, who is good friends with the girls. Jesse is attempting to solve these murder mysteries but is stifled by the town's tight lips and unsupportiveness. Enjoying the supporting cast of the characters, Coleman noted, in some way this is a book about Molly. Her regrets are about her past boyfriends wanting to be a big city cop and her desire to be a patrol officer. She and Jesse are the central figures here. In this book, we see some of her personality other than the wisecracking person to Jesse. What I'm doing with the series is writing the story of the supporting characters. There were about 12 books about Jesse, and the supporting characters played minor roles. But all the characters are so rich, I think there's an opportunity to write their stories. That is the genius of Robert Parker. He left space to explore these characters and the town of Paradise. For those readers new to the series, Jesse Stone is a law enforcement officer in the mold of Michael Connelly's Harry Bosch. They both have insecurities and will push the line to make sure the victims gain justice. With both Jesse and Harry, they see themselves as providing victims a voice. But Jesse is his own character since his life is based on regrets. He's more of the mold of the Old West Sheriff, a combination of Matt Dillon and Wyatt Earp. Coleman commented to Black5.net, "All Jesse Stone books, to some extent, are about regret and struggling. He is really a hands-on guy who women adore. He's a tough guy, very athletic, one of the top former homicidal cops in Los Angeles, and currently the police chief of a beautiful New England town. Since there is not much fault to these attributes, he has to have something the average person can relate with, which is his struggles with alcohol and his regret of being injured, causing him not to have a professional baseball career. Because Robert Parker always thought of his characters in a Western sort of way, I think the reality is Jesse is somewhere between Dylan and Earp. The author also gave a heads up that in January 2016 he's going to have his own book out. The main character, Gus Murphy, is a retired Suffolk County, Long Island cop who is happy with his life. Not an overly ambitious guy, but he is satisfied to live a life of retirement, having a great pension, a wonderful wife, and two mostly grown children. But a family tragedy unravels his life, and this first book begins 2 years after the tragedy. Gus finds his way back to life when he decides to help solve the murder of the son of someone he arrested years ago. Coleman is also busy with next year's Jesse book, Debt to Pay, which will bring back Diana, the former FBI agent. She and Jesse are romantically involved and working on a case together as the villain Mr. Peppers makes a reemergence. Anyone looking for a good mystery should read Coleman. He's taken up the torch of Robert Parker, who died just a couple of years ago, and he's allowed Jesse Stone to grow as a character. His plots are action-packed and fast-moving, while the characters are relatable and likable. The Devil Wins is a riveting and suspenseful novel. And I think you'll enjoy that. The Devil Wins, a Robert Parker novel by Reed Farrell Coleman. The next book we're going to take a look at that was very popular in October at the North Carolina Library for the Blind was a book called Driving Heat by Richard Castle. This is a very unique book. Richard Castle, a New York Times mega best-selling mystery writer and star of ABC's hit primetime show Castle, is back. In the seventh of his popular Nikki Heat series, the NYPD's top homicide detective has been promoted to captain just in time to face a thrilling case with a very personal twist. Captain Heat's fiance, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Jameson Rook, is deep in an investigation. Professionally for Heat, Rook's meddling in the case compromises her new job. Privately, it becomes an early test of their engagement when Rook becomes a distraction at best and an obstacle at worst as their parallel lives not only cross but collide. This is such an interesting book because a thing to note here, if you're not familiar with the TV show Castle, is that Richard Castle is the stage name for this character that is in this series, and ABC decided to basically hire somebody, whom we don't really know who it is, to write all these books under the name of Richard Castle. And in the book itself, if you see the book, it actually has the author in the back. It describes Richard Castle and gives his biography, which is based on the character in the TV show. I've personally never seen anything like it before, but I have to tell you, I've read of these seven books, I've read two of them, I think, and I enjoy the TV show as well, and it really is quite interesting. I was surprised to see it. It was one of the most popular books in the month of October at the North Carolina Library for the Blind. Time for a couple of more short reviews here. Another popular book in October was called Make Me, a Jack Reacher novel by Lee Child. Why is this town called Mother's Rest? Well, that's all Reacher wants to know, but no one will tell him. It's a tiny place hidden in 1,000 square miles of wheat fields with a railroad stop and sullen and watchful people and a worried woman named Michelle Chang, who mistakes him for someone else, her missing partner, in a private investigation she thinks must have started small and then turned lethal. Reacher has no particular place to go and all the time in the world to get there, and there's something about Chang. So he teams up with her and starts to ask around. He thinks, how bad can this thing be? But before long, he's plunged into a desperate race through L.A., Chicago, Phoenix, and San Francisco, and through the hidden parts of the Internet, up against thugs and assassins every step of the way, right back to where he started, in Mother's Rest, the name of the town, where he must confront the worst nightmare he could imagine. Walking away would have been easier, but as always, Reacher's rule, if you want me to stop, you're going to have to make me. Make Me is the name of the novel, a Jack Reacher novel by Lee Child, and books by Lee Child are on the top 10 list almost every month at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. And we have time for just one more here on this program. The Killing Kind is the name of the book by Chris F. Holm. That's H-O-L-M. A hitman who only kills other hitmen winds up a target himself. Michael Hendricks kills people for money. That aside, he's not so bad a guy. Once a covert operative for a false flag unit of the U.S. military, Hendricks was presumed dead after a mission in Afghanistan went sideways. He left behind his old life and beloved fiancée and set out on a path of redemption, or perhaps one of willful self-destruction. Now Hendricks makes his living as a hitman, entrepreneur of sorts. He only hits other hitmen. For 10 times the price on your head, he'll make sure whoever's coming to kill you winds up in the ground instead. Not a bad way for a guy with his skill set to make a living, but a great way to make himself a target. The book is called The Killing Kind by Chris F. Holman, and it was one of the most popular books on the North Carolina Library for the Blind list. And I think that you would probably enjoy that one. Chris Holm is somebody that I am actually not very familiar with. Most of the books now, since I've been doing this program for a couple of years now, most of the books are written by people that are familiar to me. Chris Holm is not. But he sounds like a good one, and I think you'd enjoy it. The Killing Kind by Chris Holm. We'll have more next month. Because we had that long review about Go Set a Watchman this month, didn't have time to get through all of them. The other books during the month of October that were very popular, The Bullet by Mary Louise Kelly, The Fixer by Joseph Finder, and a book called Truth or Die by James Patterson and Howard Ruffin. And that's a book that's been popular for, the last 2 or 3 months or so. So next time we may have a chance to do some short summaries of those books as well. But for now, that's all the time we have for this month's edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately? I'm George Douglas. I hope you enjoyed the program today. If you'd like more information about how to become a patron of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, simply Google or search for North Carolina Library for the Blind or call toll-free 1-888-388-2460. 1-888-388-2460. You can also use that number and website to join the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. It's that wonderful group that sponsors this program on books. This program is intended for a print and visually handicapped audience. Heard Any Good Books Lately will be available right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Thanks for joining me. I'm George Douglas. Nice to have you with me, and join us again next month. So long, until next time.